Welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Audrey Sternberg. As part of its Between the Lines program, Cancer Network hosted a discussion with Dr. Paul G. Richardson of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Dr. Christina Gasparetto of the Duke Cancer Institute to discuss a manuscript on the use of proteasome inhibitors for relapsed refractory multiple myeloma.
So in terms of our discussion this evening, we were going to talk about proteasome inhibition in the treatment of relapsed refractory myeloma. And really our focus was to recognize that with all the excitement that there is in multiple myeloma, with multiple other therapies available, obviously including monoclonal antibodies, immunomodulatory drugs, cellular therapies, and other more novel small molecules, it's important to remember our backbone agents include proteasome inhibition. And this has been a mainstay of therapeutics in myeloma for the last 22 years, in fact, to be precise. So with that in mind, as we think about this, the emphasis on bortezomib as our first-in-class boronate peptide with IV and subcutaneous administration and FDA approval as long ago as 2003, in fact, had a major impact on survival. And now I'd love to ask Christina to comment on, of course, the impact of carfilzomib.
Well, carfilzomib, of course, changed a little bit the field. Is a phenomenal drug and impacted on the outcome, on the life of many patients of myeloma. And we do have in the approved carfilzomib in combination with dexamethasone and carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone as part of the ASPIRE and the ENDEAVOR study. And of course, IV administration. And it's been, I can't believe it's been almost 10 years, actually 10 years, it was approved in 2012. So an amazing, phenomenal drug still used in many of the newer combination for treatment of both the newly diagnosed and the relapsed refractory disease.
I think that's very well said, Christina. And I think the other exciting thing that's so interesting is that the test of time, you touched on the fact that it's been 10 years since carfilzomib
10 years,
the relapsed refractory disease, and it's a mainstay of therapy in relapse. And obviously has made an impact in upfront treatment now as well. And bortezomib, of course, has been a mainstay of both upfront and relapse disease. And both drugs have really held their position as primary proteasome inhibitors of choice in our combination strategies and in the various places where we deploy proteasome inhibition for our patients. And so I'd just then love to move to the third member of the proteasome inhibitor family, exazomib, and have your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, we were all very excited from this drug, right? When it was first approved in 2015, it's the first oral proteasome inhibitor. So we were all thinking about convenience and different strategies for our patients. So I think it's an intriguing drug because it's effective, but we have some concerns about the power of this drug in different combinations. And so I'm glad that we can open a discussion tonight. But definitely a very interesting and important drug in the field of myeloma, right?
I absolutely agree. And I think that the important point is that, you know, we have bortezomib as the boronate peptide of choice for intravenous subcutaneous use. Carfilzomib as an epoxy ketone that's an irreversible inhibitor of the 20S subunit and with a particular benefit in terms of being covalently binding and that much more powerful. But the critical differences between the two lie, of course, in tolerabilities with different patterns of tolerability. And obviously, we've gotten so much better at knowing how to manage their side effects. Be it, you know, cardiovascular in the context of carfilzomib or neurotoxicologically in the setting of bortezomib. But I think what's so exciting about ixazomib, and I agree with you, is that as an orally bioavailable boronate peptide, that rapid on, rapid off pharmacology has always made it very attractive, particularly for our frailer patients, and in particular with the convenience of oral administration once a week, which in combination with other strategies has, particularly in what we're dealing with over the last 2 years with the pandemic, I think has been especially helpful, hasn't it?
Richardson and Gasparetto then shared their insight on how real-world experience and data with proteasome inhibitors in multiple myeloma compared to what was seen in clinical trials.
And in terms of making sense of the data around ixazomib use, I just wanted to emphasize how we found that when we translate from phase three information to clinical practice, how certain drugs have performed. And in that context, when we look at various classes of drugs we've used, when we look at proteasome inhibitors, it's very interesting to see that certainly in terms of oral proteasome inhibitors, there's been a high degree of reproducibility from what we've seen in carefully controlled phase three trials into real world practice. And I just wondered, Christina, your impressions of this, because again, I think this has become a very important aspect of what we do.
I think that the evolution of myeloma over the last 20 years, the introduction of many drugs, and we're becoming more sophisticated on understanding the biology of the disease, following patient. But I think there is a dichotomy here with how we treat patients aggressively in academia versus what's going on in the real world. Are patients able to sustain therapy for a prolonged period of time? Are able to sustain the toxicity of some of the strategies that we are proposing? And so I think this is opening a huge conversation. You know, we're impacting on the survival of patients with myeloma, but not necessarily all patients, right? I think that we still have a fair amount of patients with myeloma treated, unfortunately. I don't want to use the word suboptimally, but while we are improving the outcome, the survival of patients with myeloma is not necessarily for all patients. And so I want to hear your thought about, you know, presentations that are actually part of it.
Yeah, Christina, I think you're touching on an absolutely critical point. And that critical point is that in the context of clinical trials, there are highly selected patients who have outstanding performance status and reflect a patient population who do not necessarily really prove to be representative of what goes on in real world practice. And so in academic centers where, for example, the achievement of maximal high quality response, you know, the holy grail of MRD negative status, which I have many cautions about, frankly, myself, particularly in the relapse refractory setting. Obviously, in the upfront setting, some different considerations, but in relapse refractory disease, you know, a disease control that's associated with high quality of life and minimal toxicity by virtue of effective therapy is a win. And that doesn't necessarily involve driving for maximal response.
Then the conversation led to their perspectives on data from the Tourmaline MM1 trial, which tested ixazomib therapy in patients with relapse refractory multiple myeloma.
When you look at the impact of oral proteasome inhibition more broadly, it was a privilege to be part of the Tourmaline MM1 study. And our recent report published in the JCO, where we showed the final overall survival analysis, crystallizes a lot of the points you just made. And I think the important message here is that in this study where we randomized patients to ixazomib, lenalidomide, and dex to lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and placebo, we were able to show that the overall survival in the long-term follow-up of this study did not meaningfully change between the two arms. Great news for patients because it meant those patients assigned to the control group obviously had excellent salvage therapies because there was, of course, a significant PFS advantage to the triplet over the doublet. But it also points, I think, to another fact, which is that interpreting overall survival in the relapse refractory space in myeloma is increasingly complicated because it depends on salvage therapies. And I think that as we think of interpreting data in this space, that becomes an additional consideration. So I wondered, Christina, what your thoughts were from this overall survival analysis from Tourmaline.
I think you're absolutely right. It's with the introduction of so many newer therapies, it's impossible, right? Because we are, the Tourmaline one was targeting patients in early relapse. So we're looking for prolongation of durability of response. And of course, the overall survival ultimately is the major endpoint, right? Can we prolong the life of patients with myeloma? But this is good and bad. Bad because we didn't show that with this combination that we could impact on the overall survival, but very good because, yes, we can rescue patients with additional therapies. So, you know, again, that's the reason why I do have a lot of questions about this combination in the newly diagnosed setting as well as in the relapse setting. However, it is still an effective combination. I think you can interpret the data either ways, right?
I think this is a very interesting point you make, because in the relapse refractory space, there are a couple of other studies we need to just be aware of. In the Bellini trial, of course, with venetoclax, we saw a substantial PFS benefit across the board, but the survival actually switched. And then for those patients who were not 1114 translocated, there was actually survival loss and decrement, pointing to a very different phenomenon. That's obviously not what we're seeing here. What we're seeing here is, to your point, Christina, the fact that the triplet generates PFS advantage in early relapse, but fortunately, in terms of the numerous options that are available, that doesn't mean an overall survival difference in terms of longer-term follow-up. But critically, it also tells us that the exazimib platform, by virtue of its excellent tolerability, also does not do harm later, which I think is very relevant in terms of tolerability issues, be they complex, not only, for example, the acute toxicities or chronic toxicities, but changes to the disease biology itself, which has been one of the concerns raised from Bellini, that somehow was venetoclax in the non-1114 patients generating something more adverse in their tumor biology, because certainly some of the data might have suggested that. So I think that when we see trials in relapsed refractory disease where there's PFS benefit but no OS benefit, especially if it's an early relapse, this kind of makes sense. Where I'm a little bit more cautious is if we see very substantial PFS benefit and we still don't see an OS benefit, but it may be similar, because that tells me something different, which may be that if you've got a big PFS benefit but no OS benefit, there may be subsets of patients in those two categories who are benefiting and not benefiting in the longer term. But that's not what we're seeing in Tourmaline. We saw a very reasonable PFS benefit in favor of the three drugs over the two, but not enormous. Nonetheless, translating into survival equivalence with no evidence of a tolerability profile being challenging or difficult for patients in real world practice. And that's being shown.
Richardson rounded out the discussion by exploring the triplet combination of izazimib, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone in relapse refractory multiple myeloma, presented at the 2021 American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting.
I thought we could finish our discussion today by focusing on a really interesting new approach in terms of the relapse refractory space of combining izazimib with pomalidomide. And really just to showcase and discuss with you two studies that were, one which was presented by my colleague at ASH in December of last year, and also the second study for which there was a press release, which I can speak to, led by my colleague Peter Voorhees, and of which you were part as a much valued Alliance member. And at the same time, just share with our audience that the data from the second study will actually be presented at this year's EHA in Vienna. But suffice to say, for this first study, this was an exploration of ixazomib combined with pomalidomide. But because we all recognize ixazomib so well tolerated, is there the capability to go up to higher dosing in the relapsed refractory space, as we'd originally done in the phase one efforts years ago and shown that was possible, but do so in a way to be more active? Because you touched on it very nicely earlier, there is a sense with ixazomib that the weekly dosing is very well tolerated, but the punch of it is somewhat diminished, and you captured that beautifully earlier. So with that in mind, I just wanted to review the data with you. In this study, what we did in the relapsed refractory space was explore three dose cohorts. The first dose cohort was at 3 milligrams of pomalidomide and 3 milligrams of ixazomib. And at the same time, the second dose cohort was 3 milligrams of ixazomib, 4 milligrams of pomalidomide. And then the third dose cohort was at 4 milligrams for both. And we adjusted the steroids, as you'd imagine, for the older folks. What was really interesting, Christina, was that we were able to actually get up to dose level 3, 4 milligrams of ixazomib twice a week, and pomalidomide, 4 milligrams, full dosed. But critically, I did want to share with everyone that the cycle length was made to be 21 days because we realized you probably weren't going to be able to continue the pomalidomide for a full 21 days in that setting without overlapping toxicities. So we truncated the pomalidomide to 2 weeks on, 1 week off. The dexamethasone was partnered on the day of the ixazomib and the day after to improve tolerability. And the ixazomib was given days 1, 4, 8, and 11. So I just wonder what your impression of this data was. Results I think you're very familiar with. And we were able to get a very solid response rate, approximately 60% with this platform, but in a very heavily pretreated population who were enriched for resistance, including high-risk cytogenetics. And again, very favorable tolerability. So I just wonder what you thought of this.
I think this is also a very important point. I always think the elderly and why we are unable to impact on the older populations with myeloma, the survival is shorter. And there is nothing different with the biology of the disease, but the difference is that we tend to adjust dosage, right? We tend to treat them suboptimally because we want to avoid the toxicity. So this drug initially was approved in the weekly basis, and we all had the impression that maybe it was not as strong as bortezomib or carfilzomib, but we had in the back of the mind that maybe the dosage was not correct. There was a suboptimal dose. So having a study where the ixazomib is given a full potential and showing the benefit in combination with the pomalidomide in this situation, which I love it. I love the fact that it's another oral combination and performing quite well and tolerable, I think is a very important point, right? So we need to treat the patients aggressively. We need to use this drug at the maximum dose to achieve effectiveness. And so I'm glad that we have a study showing that ixazomib given in a twice a week schedule can actually perform quite well in patients heavily pretreated. So I think this was a very good study providing us with good information. So when we are choosing this combination in the relapse setting. So, I think it was a positive and important point.
Thank you, Christina. And I agree, for my patients participating in the trial, number one, the combination has been well tolerated, and two, they've had higher risk disease, they've been more heavily pretreated. And at the same time, whilst they're obviously pomalidomide naive, they're nonetheless patients in whom I would want a powerful proteasome inhibitor presence to be effective. So these were all then refractory, and all the patients had to be relapsed and refractory to enter the study. And as I mentioned, we're enriched for high-risk cytogenetics. So we were encouraged by what we saw. And I think what's really interesting, and I so agree with you, is that in the context of tolerability and continuity of therapy, or being able to continue treatment rather. In the COVID era, this was a very attractive combination for patients because all oral, minimal visits to the clinic, you know, really, really important. And I think that, that's a very, very key aspect of all oral regimens, is if you can minimize that risk. And I think also, and I think both of you and I have this experience, whilst we're so impressed by the antibody platforms, there is no doubt that there is a risk of pulmonary infection associated with their use. And obviously with potent antibodies targeting CD38, there is of course a significant effect on B cells broadly, and that mm-hmm. leads to hypogammaglobulinemia and all the things that we think may in fact increase or magnify the risk of infection of whatever source, be it COVID or otherwise.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review to tell us what you think and what you want to hear more about. Oncology Peer Review On The Go is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or at Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.